Buckle up, college basketball fans, because Iconic Seasons is taking a trip down memory lane with an iconic player interview. This week, we're soaring high with the legend Jack Goose Givens, the man who led the 1978 Kentucky Wildcats to a national championship and stole the show in the Final Four. Get ready to relive the magic as Goose dives deep into his incredible journey. And there's more. This exclusive interview is just a taste of the incredible stories Goose shares in his new book, co-authored by the prolific Doug Brunk, a literary heavyweight in his own right. Let's get started. So I'm thinking about 78. Actually, we talked about 79, but I'll definitely ask you a question about questions about the 78 season. And I'm curious about the World Invitational Tournament, too, just about your experience with that. So I think that this is a really almost like a nexus in college basketball. I know a lot of people look at that 1979 Final Four, but man, you look at the names on the 78 thing with UK, Duke, Arkansas, Notre Dame, and just the players and your play in that final game. I'm like, a lot of times when we look back, we think about, oh, it was this one moment. But I think it's the overall quality of play that you guys and so many others brought to the game that really started to elevate NCAA basketball. It's not just that one Final Four. It's just the quality of the product is just going up exponentially. Mm-hmm. And I think people finally galvanize. And then in retrospect, maybe they pick, 79 as the season, you know, after Bird and Magic get to the pros and do it differently. But yeah, we'll get into all that. But let's start here. So just give me your origin story. We like to talk about just like, how did basketball capture your interest? You spent a lifetime in basketball. So what was it about basketball that captured your interest and became so central to your life?
Well, I think basketball for me was a little bit of an afterthought. I mean, growing up, I was more interested in baseball, and I played a lot of baseball and was a pretty decent baseball player, I guess, and was kind of wanting to do just that. But I think was junior high school, middle school nowadays, you know, I grew probably 6 inches one summer. And from that time on, I was more focused on basketball. I mean, I liked basketball, didn't love it at the time. And when that growth spurt hit, it just kind of was what I did and where I went. And that's kind of how I got involved. Yeah, I found out at that time that I was halfway decent at it and was blessed to have some good coaches in junior high school and then in high school. So that's just kind of how basketball came along. We played in the neighborhood all the time, for sure. So it was there, and it was big. I mean, basketball back in those days were good. So it was just a natural progression for me.
Now, you said the neighborhood, so we love playground stories. So I'm thinking that around that time probably was on the playground somewhere outside. Mm-hmm. So what was the court you played at growing up like?
Well, I think the first thing is where we grew up, we didn't have a lot of other opportunities, a lot of other options than to participate in neighborhood sports. Mm. I mean, we played as the seasons moved. I never was that interested in football, although we played in the parks. We played football, but the basketball part of it was pretty huge. I mean, it was a way of life. I mean, there were a bunch, I'm talking about many, many really good high school basketball players who came before me and leading up to me, teams who were really good teams, didn't get the coverage because at that time, black schools just didn't get that kind of coverage. I mean, that was just part of it. Black athletes didn't get, well, black basketball players didn't get the opportunity to play at a lot of major colleges, especially in the South. So, but we played in the playgrounds like we were all going to go to a big time school.
Yeah.
And just like many other inner city situations, playground legends were everywhere you looked. I mean, there were great players, and some of the leagues we played in, the Dirt Bowl and was a great league that gave all of us an opportunity to play good big-time summer basketball. It was, I mean, we played, just like the name implies, we played on dirt. We didn't have concrete courts for when that league first started. So we played basketball outside, and we played it hard, and we knew if we lost, we were going to have to sit out 5 or 6 games, you know, till your team rotated back around again. So we competed to stay on the court. We tried our best not to lose. And for us at that time, that was all the motivation we needed. So, you know, street ball, high school ball, I mean, summer league ball in the parks were a big part of what we did at that time.
Simpler times, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. We didn't have a lot of options, that's for sure.
Well, I can hear a little bit in there, but I got to throw it to Doug here, who's our other guest. We've had him on before talking about his other Kentucky books and an author of numerous books. But I got to ask then about the origin of this book. How did the idea for this come together, and what was who's the initiator here in this project?
Well, I would give a rare assist to the COVID pandemic. Those first few weeks after the lockdowns went in effect were tough on everyone. And I got restless and had an itch to work on another book project for the University Press of Kentucky. And in the back of my mind, I was like, I think this would help me keep my head on straight rather than go down the rabbit hole of worry of what was going on around me, to work on a project that was tangible. So I think it was April of 2020, I emailed Jack and ask what he thought about perhaps working with me on a book about his life story. He and I have known each other for about 14 years now, and he contributed to my 2 previous book projects. So we know each other, and he's such an iconic figure in UK basketball history as the first African American player to wear the blue and white. And he's a relentless ambassador for the program to this day, and consistently positive. So I personally was curious about his life story. So I figured Big Blue Nation would be too. And Jack replied to that first email thanking me for asking, but said he'd need some time to think about it. And several weeks went by without hearing anything. So I began to think, oh, maybe he's not interested in working on a memoir with me. So I emailed him one day to follow up to see where he stood. And instead of replying by email, I think it was a few days later, Jack left a voicemail on the phone, on my cell phone, saying he wanted to proceed. So soon after that, we were off and running.
That's amazing. So I'm throwing it to you then, Jack. What's the flip side of that coin? Like, what do you think? Because I think some of your story is obviously known just in the national media. You know, I could just Google on YouTube your highlights and stories about you. So there's a lot that's out there, but what made you want to then tell it from your perspective? Because I think that is a unique opportunity for anyone, but also maybe a little bit intimidating too.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping Doug would go away. You know, I was nice because I knew him and responded to his first email, give me some time to think about it. He did that, but then he responded again. And I had been asked before, hey, why don't we do a book? Why wouldn't you want to do one? And I just kind of never thought I had anything worth talking about, frankly. It wasn't me. But after Doug approached me and I had a comfort level with him, I decided to go on and give it a try. Just thinking, well, we would get into this and Doug would realize I was right. I don't have anything anybody wants to hear about. But it was really neat because the more we got into stuff and the more Doug poked and prodded and kind of helped me to open up and to tell some of that story, I realized that, well, maybe it is good to get some of this stuff out and to relive and to talk about and to really some things I hadn't thought about for a bunch of years. We started kind of walking in some territory that I haven't visited in a long time. And it became more and more interesting to me, some of these things. So whether it was kind of interesting to anybody else, came to the point where it mattered, but it didn't matter as much. So we continued to go. And as we did, we kind of put together something that I'm very, very proud of and happy with, and have gotten feedback from a bunch of folks who seem to enjoy it also, and very appreciative of me for putting it out and talking about some of that stuff.
Yeah, I this could be for either of you, but I'm curious how you started to shape then the narrative of it, because you kind of start in chronological order. But I think the items that you pick, especially at the beginning of the book, help to form the idea of the culture that you came into and the choices that you had to make coming into Kentucky. Because it's pretty known at this point that Rupp was not for having African-American or Black players at Kentucky. And then Joby Hall comes in, and there's issues in this different era. And you're part of this transition time, but you talk about Lexington at the time. And I just thought it was a fascinating portrait. I mean, I'm 1979, so right, that's when I was born. So right in the time that in my lifetime, how different things have been for the better. But what was it like to try to look back at that time and craft a narrative around what was happening in Lexington and on a larger part in the country?
Well, Doug, why don't you speak to that first, and then I'll follow up after you finish.
Okay. Well, once Jack and I agreed to work together, we were required to put together a book proposal for the University Press of Kentucky, which is standard protocol for most publishers. So Jack and I spent a couple of phone calls in that summer of 2020 putting that together. And that was sort of a outline of his life story from the 30,000 foot level, so to speak, where I asked him, okay, what big picture themes do you envision being most important in this book? So we kind of talked about those and factored those into the proposal. And once we got that done, we started to write mostly chronologically, starting with his earliest memories from childhood. And I thought it would be useful to work in blocks of sort of 10-year increments. So we started from those earliest days. And so when he talked about his siblings and mother, for example, I asked him to describe them as he would a perfect stranger, to get a sense of their character. And from that, good anecdotes started to come out. And we started to do that for almost everybody who was important in his life. So we got a pattern going early on. Anything you'd like to add, Jack?
Well, I kind of thought it was important to, I mean, so often people, you're viewed, if you have any kind of success at all, people think you've always been there and that you had an advantage over what they might have had growing up, whatever way they did. So I thought it was important that part of the story be told. One of 10 kids whose father was not in the home very often, living in a housing project, a 3-bedroom housing project, and having to sleep on floors and, you know, not knowing exactly where your next meal is going to come from. All of those kind of things that you hear about, but you hear about it always from someone else. I thought it was good that we get into some of those stories. And look, I don't know that I would have talked about that, except that it was a part of my life, because that was a wonderful, I mean, that was a great part of my life. I mean, those days, I didn't have much, but I didn't know I didn't have much because I didn't know what else. I mean, what else was out there? I had what I had, and we did what we did, and all of that was good. I mean, I wouldn't change a thing about it. There are a lot of people who will read this book and who I've met throughout my life that didn't grow up that way, that don't know what it's like to not have to be one of 10 and to not have anything, you know, and to not know where their next meal would come from. There are a lot of people who don't know what that's like. So after Doug and I started getting into it, you know, we found out that that was an interesting part of my life and one that a lot of people wouldn't even think was possible because of the way I'm perceived now and to a lot of people. So that all was good. And we just walked through all of that stuff and it was fun doing it.
Yeah. The hard work, your mom comes off as a real star in that too, but the whole family coming together, it was very interesting too. You know, now a prep star, like you might've been at like IMG Academy or some, you know, high school like that. And just your mom moving to a new school, like, oh, I'm just at a new school now. Just little things like that really showed the difference in the times. And, you know, it seems like a small thing to go through, but you know, as a kid, changing schools is a big deal, especially back then.
Yeah, and I did want to make sure my mom, some of her story was told because she was a star and she's a superstar and she's my hero, my one and only hero growing up was her. And some of the sacrifices she made were just unbelievable. But again, it was a way of life for us. She did it and she willingly did it. And I really wanted to make sure people knew that my family was my rock. I mean, that's what helped me more than anything else. And, you know, I do like the fact that I was able to define who they were and what that part of my life, my family life was like and how that helped to shape who I am today.
Before we get back to our conversation with Jack and Doug, I wanted to take just a minute to talk about something that I've been using to create a new routine and consistently keep my focus and energy up, especially when I'm doing creative things like this podcast. I want to talk to you about Magic Mind. It's something that I've been using that has become part of my routine. It's so easy to incorporate. It's basically like what I used to use for 5-hour energy for, but is made from all natural ingredients. So it doesn't give me that jittery feeling. And that's what I've been really enjoying about it. It's got no sugar, nut-free, vegan, keto, paleo-friendly. So it's just one of those things that is easy to incorporate into whatever you're doing, but also brings energy and focus and enhances the creativity in that moment. If you're interested in trying it out, I've got a link and a discount code. You can go to magicmind.com/199. That's the number 19 and the word 9, N-I-N-E. And you can get up to 50%, 56% off your first subscription or 20% off a one-time purchase. Again, 19.9 for 56% off. I recommend you give it a try. I really have been enjoying it and been several weeks that I've been using it on a pretty consistent basis. It's just kind of an add-on to my coffee routine. Easy to carry with you and take at any point throughout the day. All right, let's get back to the conversation. Switching gears then, I'm kind of curious to continue a little bit on that strand. What did your family think as you chose the University of Kentucky? And what was the transition like then from high school to being on campus? Because it had to be kind of a cultural shift too from you know, even within Lexington, from where you were to being on campus and the you know, focal point that comes with it or the spotlight that comes with that.
Well, you know, believe me, it wasn't the first choice for most of my family and most of the people who lived in the neighborhood I grew up in. I mean, just like I said a little while ago, there were players who would play circles around me when it comes to how good they were in basketball, and they didn't even get considered. University of Kentucky wasn't an option for them. They didn't get considered to be players at the University of Kentucky. So the university wasn't looked on highly in my circle. Mm-hmm. And I had to convince my mom that when I did decide to go there, that, mom, everything's going to be all right. It's different. It's changing. And, you know, it took some convincing. My siblings were they were all real happy for the opportunity that I had to play there, and they supported me. But when it came to my neighborhood and folks who grew up before me and folks who were around me and some influencers in my life, either through my church and or either through the leagues, the playground ball that I was playing at that time, they weren't so sure. And fortunately, I did get the support from, ultimately got the support from folks that everything was going to be all right. I played a lot as a freshman, which helped me because there were a number of people who didn't believe I'd ever step foot on the court. It was just the way it was. Nothing about the talent or lack of that I had. They all trusted in my talent. They just didn't trust in the opportunity that was there at the University of Kentucky. But as I and James Lee, who was also from Lexington, we committed to the University of Kentucky to play basketball at the same time. But as I and James started to get more attention at the university, we got playing time, the community gathered around us in a huge way and supported us every step of the way. But it wasn't an easy decision. It wasn't a popular decision at that time, but it was one that we made, and we quickly started getting the support of all the people around us.
Yeah, getting on the court and getting wins often gets you the support, huh?
Well, the wins were one thing.
Yeah,
but the acceptance amongst the university community wasn't very big in our community and didn't have a whole lot of African-Americans who even went to school there, let alone who supported the university athletics and followed them. And so, yeah, it was all right. The wins were good. But the fact that James and I both played and were prominent in the program and the success of the program as freshmen, that figured into it more even than the wins did, because the only thing the folks in the community wanted was for us to have a honest opportunity, a good faith opportunity to play. And once they saw that things, in fact, had changed, and once they saw that we got opportunities, whether we were good or bad or indifferent, that is what kind of won the community over. The wins were great.
Yeah,
all of that is good. But, you know, they just wanted us to be able to realize the opportunity that was there. And once we did, they came on board quickly.
Yeah, acceptance is a great word. So, yeah. Doug, when you were getting into this portion of the story, were you looking back at any archival information from the university, or, you know, how do you start to craft the narrative around Jack's arrival at the school? Are you just relying on his kind of take of it, or do you like to look back at articles and from the time and press releases and information?
Well, from working on my two previous books, I knew how much of a trailblazer Reggie Warford was. You know, the first African-American basketball player to graduate from the university, stay 4 years. And, you know, Jack talks about a lot about his influence on him personally in the book as a huge mentor. So I knew that. What was interesting to me, you know, Jack mentioned how few students there were on campus. So I did find some information with the help of folks in the UK archives library. And I think it was between the time Jack entered as a freshman and graduated as a senior, I think the proportion of African-American students went from like 1.3% to 1.8%. So it was... Talk about slow to integrate. Yeah. I mean, not only on the courts of the athletic fields, but, you know, as an institution, that was a real wake up. It was jarring to me,
Yeah, it's hard to hear that even now.
And when we include that statistic in the book, so I am just so happy to have participated in this story, which is one of bringing people together. And as Jack said, once the people in his community and circles saw that he and James were getting playing time and respect, not only did they get the support, but Jack, you talk about this, they started to show up at the games mm-hmm. and started to wear UK mm-hmm. gear around town, whereas before wow. that was like a no-no, right?
Yes.
So yeah, that was all interesting to me.
That's an amazing perspective, yeah. That had to be a real change, too, to go back to your neighborhood and see people wearing UK gear. That is a real change, I'm sure, to notice.
Yes, it was.
Well, let's talk a little bit. I'd be remiss not to talk just a little bit about the championship. Now, there's a ton of Kentucky memories in here, so I'm not going to get into all of them because people need to go buy the book. It's a really great read. But I've got to ask you about the national championship, of course, and scoring 41 points in the national championship. It can't get old talking about that. So just any memory you want to share about that. And I'm kind of curious, too, about how losing maybe the year before helped to galvanize you guys going into that championship season. Because looking at the 1987 Hoosiers, you know, it was their season on the brink before they win the national championship. And they had gone through a lot as a team. So I'm kind of curious just about how teams are built, especially in this era where guys stay together a little bit longer.
Yeah, you know, it'd be hard to talk about the championship year without reliving because that was my senior year, but without reliving what had happened the previous 3 years when it came to the teams that we had. I mean, listen, as a freshman, we got to the final game against John Wooden and UCLA, you know, his final game. And, you know, that's an amazing thing yeah. in itself to get to the finals. And that was awesome. But the thing is, it was my freshman year, and as a freshman, I'm thinking, hey, it's going to be like this every year. You know?
I mean,
that's just who we are. I mean, that's college basketball.
Yeah.
So it was good to go through it as a freshman, not having all the pressure on me to go out and perform every game, because I was a freshman. We had seven seniors and some really, really good players on that team. So I went through it and I got the feel as to what it's like to get to that, to be one of the last two teams playing. That was, even though we lost it, it was unbelievably important to go through it and to experience that. Then as a sophomore, I had to learn very quickly that no, what we went through last year was not college basketball. You were very fortunate to get there. And because my sophomore year, we were 10-10 at one point, and they were talking about us having a losing season at the University of Kentucky, and one of the only teams to ever have a losing season there. And it was as negative and as bad as it can get. Thank goodness we didn't have social media.
Okay.
The outlets that are there today, because I would have left school, because I'm sure some of the stuff that would have been said about us at that time would have been pretty strong negative. But we changed that around, and we got it together, and we won the NIT that year, which was huge at that time, because the NCAA only had, 32 teams or something? So there were a lot of really, really good teams in the NIT that didn't make that would nowadays have made the NCAA, that didn't make it. So it was a very good tournament and a very, very difficult tournament to win. But winning that showed us the opposite of the year before, what losing at that time of the year was about. It showed us what winning with that time of the year was about. So getting to my junior year, yeah, we lost to Carolina in the finals of the East region and missed the opportunity to get back to the Final Four, which was huge, because I thought that team was good enough to win it all that year. I mean, we were really, really good. We lost that, and that kind of set the pace for the next year, because after that, we decided that no one's leaving Lexington to go home for the summer. We decided right there to stay there. Rick Roby and myself, we were captains of the team. So we rededicated ourselves at that minute that we were going to stay there all summer, and we were going to do what it takes, what it took to get better and to be able to win it all. So the loss of that game was as important as the previous 2 years, getting to the final game and then winning a national tournament. That was huge. And we worked hard that summer, and it kind of got everything started for our championship run, which in itself was great because of the path we had to take, the pressure we had on us from the outside media, as well as the pressure we had from the folks in the Big Blue Nation to win a championship. It'd been 20 years and they were ready for another championship. And, you know, we walked through it, but it was amazing walk and an amazing career as we put that whole few years together.
Yeah. What's the 41 though in the championship like? Because I'm a lefty, so it's maybe a little easier for me to picture those sweet left-handed jump shots. But man, I watched the highlight package and just swish after swish. So did you start out nerves, and then after you hit a few, you're starting to feel the flow, or were you just feeling it from warmups?
Oh, it was a little bit of every emotion you can imagine. Getting ready for that final game. The game before us, and back then they had a consolation game for third and fourth place, that game between Notre Dame and Arkansas went into overtime. So we were trying to time everything out to be ready to go as soon as that game was over in regulation. Well, now you have another period of time where you have to sit there and try to get yourself together and try to remotivate yourself, if you will, to stay at the level you were, thinking that you were about ready to go out on the floor, to coming back to the locker room, sitting down again, and having to keep that feel that you were ready. So that in itself was a challenge. And of course, that gives your nerves more time to kick in, and the anxiety of having to wait to get out on the floor. I had to go through all of that. And to start out the game, you know, it was a struggle. I mean, we played all right, but we were fouling, and Duke made, I forget how many free throws in the first half of that game to stay in it. But at one point, I started to feel comfortable. We got adjusted to Duke's zone, which we hadn't played a lot against the zone defense, but they had a 2-3 zone. We found a couple of weaknesses in that last 5 or 6 minutes, and I think I ended up scoring the last 14 or 16 points in the first half for us, as we kind of solved where the weak spots were. I was just fortunate that their weak spots were in areas where I had scored all year long. And, you know, I still send donations to the Duke Athletic Fund because I thought for sure they were going to come out and make some changes in that zone for the second half. They didn't make a change. They kept everything the way it was, and the shots kept falling. They didn't make any adjustments. So, yeah, it was awesome for me, but that just kind of speaks to the team we had, the kind of team. I mean, we had a different guy step up in every game we had throughout the course of the tournament that year. We had that kind of team. We were a veteran team. We had some really good guys on the bench who played behind us. So we were able to figure out ways to win games. You know, beat some great teams. If you think about it, Florida State in the first game, they were good. They had us down at halftime to the extent that Coach Hall benched the starters, myself, Truman Clater and Mike Phillips. He benched us for some subs because he didn't think we were playing well. And we our bench came through and helped pull us through that game. We beat the Miami of Ohio team. That was pretty good. But Mike Phillips, who was from there, had a big game. We beat Magic Johnson and Michigan State. We beat Arkansas and Sidney Moncrief, Marvin Dell, and those guys who were really, really good. I mean, the best team we played all year was Arkansas, and Brewer was there. And so we had to do something different every game in order to get through that tournament. But obviously the game I had for the final game, if you wanted to write a script as to how you want your college career to end, I couldn't have written a better script. It was awesome. We won the championship. I had a big game, but that's secondary to winning that championship. That's for sure.
That's amazing. Just again, young people can look up, or anybody can look up that the highlights from that. Still, you could still beat a 2-3 zone like that, right in the middle. Sweet lefty jump shot, splash, nothing but net.
Yeah, that was good. I mean, that was, like I say, we had a great team. Our guards could flat shoot the ball. We didn't have a 3-point line, but a lot of the shots our guards made would have been well outside of the 3-point line. We had bigs on the inside with Roby Phillips and James Lee, where they had to always be concerned with that. So the weakness was in the middle, and I scored 80% of my points during my college career in the 15 to 17 foot range, and that's where the opening was. So they just got the ball to me, and I continued to make shots. And like I say, Duke didn't make a change. My bank account feels that because, like I say, I'm sending them the donations for not changing that. But it was a great way to go out, no doubt about it.
Amazing, amazing. Well, there's plenty more stories like that in the book, but I have to go a little off script here. You mentioned Magic Johnson. I wanted to know about the World Invitational Tournament because you play on that team with him and Bird. They're bench players, though. You're in there starting. So I was just kind of curious again because we started out talking a little bit before we came on air about the 1979 Final Four, but this is a real precursor to that. I mean, the talent level, again, the names in this Final Four with Duke, Kentucky, Arkansas, Notre Dame. I mean, they're very recognizable still to this day. So it could have been this year or the conglomerate of these years. But what was it like, the World Invitational Tournament? And then I want to switch over to Doug and ask another follow-up question about the post-Kentucky career.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, I mean, it's funny what guys remember, you know, because, you know, Magic was talking about that here recently, about that team. We had some great players. Look, we had great players on that team. Magic was on there. I mean, Larry Bird was on there. The Moncrief, all kinds of players were on that team. And believe me, any one of them could have started at that time. I would have been just fine with, I mean, we had just won the championship. Yeah. I was on cloud nine. I would have been happy with going home and just staying home and enjoying this opportunity, the win. Listen, playing with those guys were great. But the other thing you have to remember is that Coach Hall, Joe B. Hall, was the coach of that team. So who else is he going to start but the guys that brung him, you know, the guys that got him the championship? I mean, he didn't have a choice but to start us. And anybody who got caught up in and who's starting in a situation like that, it just didn't mean that much. I had totally forgotten about that until they started talking about it. I thought, oh, man, how crazy is it that that somebody after all these years.
Yeah.
But the thing that I like more than anything, man, is that at least they're still talking about you.
That's
you know?
Right. That's right.
Which is great. And I love Magic. You know, if I saw him today, we'd hug and love on each other because we just were like that. And Larry Bird's the same way. He wouldn't love and hug on anybody because that's not Larry. And you know that. But yeah, those were great days and just an unbelievably great conglomeration of talent. Mm. I mean, real talent, talented guys who were awesome, and the experience was a really good one.
That's awesome. So Doug, then approaching Jack's after college time, what was your, did you stay with the kind of 10-year increments, or did you look at it in a different way when you were approaching the time after UK?
Yes, we pretty much went down that 10-year lifespan of events, just because it, you know, from an organizational standpoint, it was seemed to make the most sense. It was easiest to do. So that's, you know, it was really fun to learn about his NBA career and then transitioning into owning a coal business and then playing overseas in Japan. So that was all stuff that I didn't know personally as a longtime fan of his. And so it's just a nice window for Big Blue Nation to.
And what was it like for you then, Jack, just thinking about those times? And then if you want to get into it, you can tell a little bit of the story. But I thought that some of the personal things that you delve into in the book really hit me. They made me almost just feel this pride for your family. Because, again, one of the through lines of the book is family. And something that stood out in some of those difficult times was, again, just your family being there for each other and you relying on them. And I just think that's a powerful message to anybody.
Yeah, you know, some of the stuff I discuss in the book, the personal things, I hadn't talked to anybody about outside my family. And some of it hadn't even talked to my family about, which were really uplifting. I mean, it was therapeutic in some ways to talk about and to get those things off my shoulder. Because listen, I was totally at a time in my life, I was totally, totally wrapped up in what the life of a former Kentucky basketball player should be. Hmm. The perception that people had, you know, I had to understand that some of the folks who were around Kentucky basketball were very, very powerful people, whether it's financially, politically, business-wise, they were very powerful people. And it's only natural for a snotty-nosed kid from me in the hood in Lexington to want a lot of the stuff those people had. I mean, they were power brokers, man. And I got caught up in that. And I got to the point where I had to have all the stuff, not all, but a lot of the stuff that those kind of people around me had, whether I had the money for it or not, you know, I could afford it. I just wanted to have it because that's what people thought I should be. And I got into that, man, and I started to accumulate stuff and started to reach out and to grab stuff. And one thing I found out was that it was easy to get money from people, man. It was a lot easier than I ever thought, whether I was earning it through work or whether I went to Joe Banker down the street and said, hey, I want this house or I want this car. I need a line of credit for my business, $1 million line of credit. It was a lot easier than I thought to get that kind of stuff. But I also learned, you know, it's easy to get, but these people want to get paid back. You know, I had to come to grips with that.
Yeah.
And the thing that really made it hit home for me was I got sick. I had ulcers. I was couldn't sleep at night. I was worrying about where payments were going to come and where the money for this was going to come and the money for that was going to come. You know, the first of the month, the mortgage is due, the car payments due, and business for me took a dive at that time. So it was just a storm of negative stuff, bad stuff. But the payments were still needing to be paid. And I woke up one morning. I'd just gotten new position with the Orlando Magic broadcasting games on TV for the Magic. And I was just great. It was, I mean, it was wonderful. But I woke up one morning to go to practice, to go down to watch the team workout. And I go out and my car is gone. And I'm thinking, man, somebody stolen my car, man. Where's my car? So I come in and I call the police and I said, sir, I went out to get in my car and it's gone and I don't know where. And I you know, and they said, the officer said to me, he said, well, let me ask you a question. I said, yes, sir. He said, are you up on your payments? And I got real quiet. You know, I was kind of like, hold it. What's that got to do with anything? Yeah. He said, well, have you made your payments? And I said, well, I'm about 3 months behind, but I've got this new job and the money's starting to come. And well, he said, well, you better call your leasing company or whoever you got your account with and check with them. And I did. And they have repossessed my vehicle. And man, that really hit home. And I got to thinking, I was like, man, at some point you got to wake up and you have to come to grips with what you can afford and what you can't and where you're going and the direction you're going in. And that incident was really one of the many things that kind of got my attention and forced me to take hold of my life and what I was doing at that time, where I was, and what I was going to do. Another thing I talk about in the book that was huge during this time was for the first time, one of the first times, maybe the first time, I got into a men's group at my church. And me and six other guys started meeting weekly to talk about what's going on in our life spiritually. And it was, I mean, I wish I could tell you how important that was. And one, the first thing I found out was that I wasn't the only one struggling. I wasn't the only one. And when you're going through that, you think, man, everybody else got it together, but me. And I realized I wasn't the only one. And I had a sports agent in that group who represented baseball players and golfers. I had, you know, a big real estate guy who sold real estate in the subdivision where Shaq and Ken Griffey Jr. and a lot of these other guys, Al Worth, Tiger Woods, lived in there. Not at that time, but later on. I mean, it was, he sold real estate in that. And I had a guy in the insurance business and all of these different walks of life. And they were struggling in ways, not just financial, but in relationship with their wife or their kids and all of these different things. And I got to thinking, well, man, what you're going through is easy compared to some of these guys. And I would recommend any man out there to find you a group to get in of guys who are going to hold you accountable and who are going to get real with you and tell you, you can't do this, or you got to change this. And that was huge. And all the stuff that happened to me after that, and fortunately, most of the stuff that happened after that time were great. They all weren't. I had another couple of situations, well, that I thought going through them, they were tough, but thanks to Doug and the fact that he in some ways made me talk about stuff that I didn't want to talk about. And not literally, but figuratively, he just, if you're going to talk about this, you got to talk about that. And I was able to unload, man, some stuff that I think people will find interesting. And obviously I'm still passionate about it because it's all in there and I could talk about this forever. I know we're going to run out of time, but man, some of the lessons that I learned, I know will help some people going through some difficult times. You know, I mean, it was just good to relive some of those and share some of those moments that I'd never shared with anyone.
I can tell you, just for me personally, it meant a lot. You know, I've gone through some things in my life too, and just somehow sharing, hearing about other people's journeys and the way that they overcome it and seeing similarities in their approach to it helps galvanize you and makes you feel stronger. Even if you've gone past that, it can kind of reaffirm the choices that you made. Because even when you're on the other side, it still is nice to be able to look back with a better perspective on it. It is a good thing that you made it through and are a stronger person on the other side of it. And it was unique to be able to read that in a book. So I appreciate that.
Yeah, I hope so. Thank you. I'm glad to hear that, because that was our intent and my intent for sure. You have to own what's happened to you in your life, but it doesn't have to define you. It doesn't have to stay with you forever. You can overcome, which was good for me.
All right, we're going to get you out of here, but I got a couple of quick hitters on the way out. Are you ready for them?
Sure.
All right. Here's the first one. Your favorite arena to play in besides Rupp?
I am in college, if you will. I enjoyed my first trip to Madison Square Garden. Okay. We won the NIT. All the games were played at Madison Square Garden at that time. It was old. But the history there was just unbelievable.
That's a classic for sure. Okay. The craziest opposing fans.
I think the craziest were LSU. And I say LSU because first and foremost, they would make us stop the bus. And when we'd pull up in front of the arena, they'd make us stop the bus and we'd have to walk past this cage that had this Bengal tiger in there.
Oh my gosh.
And I don't know who taught that thing to roar and growl and when as opposing teams walked by. But they would also let the students in early. And by the time we came out on the floor to warm up, it's like they had gone to class to learn how to come up with different stuff to kind of poke at us. And it was all clean. It was all good. Yeah. But, man, they would have even us laughing when they'd come up with some stuff. But they had some great crowd, some great fans down there at LSU.
Who is your most impressive opponent or a particular player who really impressed you?
Bernard King.
That's a great
name. He was the toughest player, maybe college and NBA, that I had to play against. He was unbelievably gifted offensively, and no matter what you did, you couldn't stop him.
I hope you've enjoyed this episode with Jack Goose Givens and Doug Brunk. If you did, leave us a rating and or review on your favorite podcast platform or on YouTube. Remember, you can pick up They Call Me Goose, My Life in Kentucky Basketball and Beyond, the intimate and all-encompassing look at the life and career of a basketball legend, from growing up in the housing project to Lexington to success with the UK men's basketball team, through his years in the NBA and all the other things we talked about on today's podcast. It's an excellent read. Get it on Amazon or wherever books are sold. Thanks again to Jack and Doug. Till next time.